When I was a kid, I spent my summers with my grandparents, and I loved it because for 2 months, I had the unconditional and undivided love of two beautiful people. I didn't have to share it with my brothers and sister. Grandpa had a lot of official jobs in Hanson. He was not a police officer, but it was his responsibility to see that the rules were obeyed. He was the welfare officer, the tree superintendent, the dog officer, and my favorite, the superintendent of cemeteries. Sometimes Grandpa would bring me with him when he had duties at the cemetery, grave digging sometimes. Probably my grandmother was delighted to have some breathing room from a granddaughter who peppered her constantly with questions. If there'd been a recent funeral, there would be beautiful bouquets that had been discarded in a colorful pile. And I could spend hours there creating beautiful bouquets to bring home to Mama, which is what I called my grandmother. I'm pretty sure she wasn't entranced by the gorgeous ribbons with the stick-on letters that said, "Rest in Peace" on them. Eventually, she instituted a new rule about how many flowers I could bring home. But she did allow some ribbons as long as I deconstructed the bows and removed the paper letters. And on rainy days, Mama and I would often play board games like Parcheesi. I didn't know you still could buy a Parcheesi board. And then she discovered Scrabble. She had been an elementary school teacher but was forced to quit when she got married. What a foolish rule. She loved games that challenged the brain. And I can still remember trying to convince her that some weird word that I had used was real, but Mama was no fool. She impressed upon me the importance of rules. You waited your turn. You didn't cheat. And you didn't sulk when you lost. And you didn't gloat if you won. I remembered that when, during the pandemic, I got hooked on playing Wordle, which is less a game of skill and really one more of luck, but you do have to remember a lot of different words. Each time I was tempted to look at the online clues, I remembered Mama's lessons and eventually decided there was a better use for my time. So much of my life following rules has been second nature to me. I'm guessing that for a lot of folks traveling on 290 and 495, that's not the case. Anyway, even though I might not have liked them at times or felt that they were unfair, still, rules were rules and meant to be followed, even if grudgingly in some cases. Then things changed in the 50s. The Civil Rights Movement highlighted the ways the rules benefit some groups of individuals at the expense of others. I had traveled in the South with my parents during that time, and I could see that there were rules that stated public places were for whites only. Entrances to buildings, water fountains, restrooms, all had these signs. And even as a kid, I knew that was wrong, but I was told by my parents, that's just the way it is. My girlfriend and I, who traveled on a bus, Greyhound bus, in 1954, knew nothing about the unspoken rule about sitting in the back of the bus, but we were white girls, so no one was going to tell us to move to the front. Thankfully, there were courageous men and women who were willing to risk everything to change the hateful system of segregation. Far too many of them lost their lives. They were willing to die for the cause. Most of us know the familiar names. Rosa Parks, who went on to be a leader. Medgar Evers, assassinated. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, assassinated. The Reverend or Fannie Lou Hamer, who publicly claimed during a hearing in Congress that she was tired of being tired. And John Lewis, who served his whole life battling for civil rights with kindness and understanding. But more than them, there were thousands who showed up to sit in and march in peaceful protests, even when they were they were attacked with fire hoses, dogs, and police batons. For so many of them, it was their fate that held them during the grueling days and the dark nights of the soul. Whether in prison or under the threat of violence, they held fast. Years later, I read MLK's letter from a Birmingham jail in which he responded to the white religious leaders who had rebuked him for breaking the rules by encouraging a civil rights march in the city. They believed that he ought to be patient and give the newly elected city officials a chance to change things. To say that these righteous folks got on Martin's last nerve is something of an understatement. In words far more eloquently than any I could compose, he laid out how patient black folk had already been for centuries, and I would add how they continue to be today. On the second Sunday of Lent, in a month when we recognize the contributions of black women and men, the ones that have made our country what it is today, today's gospel lesson is especially relevant. It's about switching expectations, switching the rules. Mark's gospel doesn't have a lot of extraneous descriptions. He's short and to the point. In the previous passages, Jesus had been on a whirlwind tour, feeding huge crowds with only a few loaves of bread and a few fish. First on one shore, the Sea of Galilee, where he fed 5,000, and then on the other side, where he fed 4,000. The rules which the disciples followed would have meant that Jesus should have dismissed the hungry folks so that they could find food for themselves. But Jesus switches the rules. The disciples are the ones who are called to gather what they have to distribute to the crowd. In short, Jesus wants them to trust that when they give up what they have, God will provide them with what they need. This is a hint that God's rules are not human rules. Jesus believes that the disciples are more interested in their roles as part of his inner circle than they are in what that might mean for them. Usually, when a leader gains a vast reputation, there is power that goes with it, along with prestige that spills over to those who surround the leader. Jesus asked the disciples who people were saying that he was. There were various responses, ranging from John the Baptist or Eli or one of the prophets. When he asked who the disciples say that he is, Peter answered for them, "You are the Messiah." In his mind, the Messiah was one who would be bringing political power to the people, overthrowing the Roman Empire. Far from being pleased, Jesus proceeds to tell them exactly what his role as the Son of Man will mean. Not power and glory, but suffering and death at the hands of those in power. One can feel the disciples' shock at his words. Peter even goes so far as to scold Jesus for bringing up such a terrible depiction of what lay ahead for him and by implication, them. I mean, who wants to sign up for that? But Jesus, rather harshly, turns it back on Peter. "Get behind me, Satan. You're setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." Now, it's important for us to remember that Satan is not the guy in the red suit with horns and a tail. Satan is the tempter, the questioner. Satan is always present in our lives, just as he was in Jesus's. You know that little voice in one's head that makes us wonder if we're enough, whether God can really love us, whether we're called to care for the lost and lonely, the ones at the margins. It's the voice that says, take care of number one, let the others take care of themselves. It's none of our business. It's the voice that urged me to remain on the sidelines when the schoolyard bullies were taunting Edna Daniels when I was in elementary school. I didn't join in, but all these years later, I feel the shame of not going into the circle to stand with her. years later. When I was in a group rehearsing for a play, that same voice urged me to stay silent when a friend came in saying Martin Luther King Jr. had been shot. And someone responded, "Good, that's one less troublemaker." How shameful not to speak up. In Mark's gospel, we don't hear the actual temptations, but he reminds us that Jesus was tempted by his time in the wilderness. His ability to resist temptation was aided by the angels who ministered to him. And he will be tempted again in the Garden of Gethsemane, in the same way the disciples will also be tempted. But for now, he will try to help not only his followers, his disciples. He will try to help them understand what they're in for. His message to them is also directed to each one of us, all who would be followers of Jesus. It pains me when I talk to young people and I hear what they think about Christians based upon what they hear and read in social media. As in Jesus' time, some folk are so concerned with following the rules that they forget the most important one. Jesus would say that there is none more important than loving God with all our heart and soul and mind. And a second one is close, to love our neighbors as ourselves. For too long, those of us who consider ourselves Christians fall short of loving neighbors, the loving neighbors part. We could plead ignorance of the racism that pervaded every aspect of our society. We could ignore the fact that men and women who served in the nation were not able to take advantage of the GI bills for college or housing, not because they weren't qualified, but because colleges or banks would not accept them based on the color of their skin. Even today, people are being denied housing based on the color of the applicant's skin. Depending upon one's zip code, in Worcester and other cities, the mortality rate can differentiate within a radius of 2 miles by as many as 7 years. Imagine that. Because you live in one place, you might die 7 years earlier than someone who lives a few streets away. Make no mistake, as our nation moves toward becoming a majority-minority nation, we will continue to have a rise in hatred toward those whose skin color is not white, or those who love others that people deem unacceptable. My belief is that fear drives the hatred. We're fearful, perhaps, that we will be treated by people of color in the same way that we have traditionally treated them. And yet, that's not been my experience. My belief is that love can overcome the hate. In many ways, the world is experiencing the same issues that Jesus experienced over 2,000 years ago, where people are divided against one another over race, class, and religion. And when you think about it, this is a story of humanity's struggle. The rich and powerful make rules that will keep them in power, while those at the margins suffer. And if we try to push back against that, we get labeled communist or socialist or hating our country. Jesus reached out to women and men who lack social standing and the powerless, social standing and the powerless, and gave them a means through which they could find healing. Perfect love casts out fear, he said. It took courage and deep faith to claim that love was the answer to what ailed the world. It still does, and it still is. I know that once you say yes, once you truly commit to being a disciple's heart and soul and mind, all the rest is easy, as Jesus promised. If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. My question for you today is, which cross are you willing to take up and carry? The answer will depend on how you see Jesus and how you see yourself as a disciple. It's not hard. And may you be encouraged every day to live as Jesus calls us to do, to love God with all our heart and soul and mind, and our neighbors as ourselves. Amen.